Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
I've never been this nervous in my life.
Greetings from Longtime No See the Podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If it's your first time here, you can actually subscribe and keep up with all of your favorite artists, discover some new ones from time to time, even know what's happening in the music world. You can find us, of course, at all the major hotspots, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and if you subscribe, you get three interviews a week, one Monday, Wednesday and Friday, delivered straight to your preferred listening device. I'm Kyle Meredith, and today I'm going to be talking with my buddy Ani DeFranco. This time, she is part of a project called the Prison Music Project, where her and Zoe Bookbinder got together. In fact, it was Zoe who kind of spearheaded the whole thing. Went into a prison and was doing some music classes, music therapy with the incarcerated there, and ended up coming out with a whole lot of songs, which they then took back and recorded with other artists for an album called Long Time Gone. Ani's going to tell us about how the whole thing came to be and collaborating with Zoe and the folks in the prison. Of course, with this, we're going to be talking politics, politics of a prison system, of a broken prison system, of a long time broken prison system, as well as Ani's views on capital punishment and citizen journalism. You know, that's something that we've especially seen plenty of in 2020 taking off. We'll also discuss the November elections, her hopes for Joe Biden. Of course, the importance of voting, 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 voting. And Ani's going to tell us about the next part of the Prison Music Project, which it looks to be a stage play. She'll have the rest of the details. Let's jump into this, discussing the Prison Music Project album called Long Time Gone. It's Kyle Meredith with Ani DeFranco.
Hey, good to see you too.
Yeah.
Good to see anybody.
Good. Well, that's sort of the thing
even
these days.
2D. You look good in 2D, pal.
Like, of course, it's interesting that anyone's releasing music during all of this. You're part of a project called the Prison Music Project that's not only timely, I guess, for what might have been going on anyways, because we're talking about the prison system here, but this ends up being like extra timely as we are in an election season and what's been going on the streets of America all across the world. I thought we'd start out with the obvious broad question here, but the Prison Music Project, what is this and how did you get involved?
Yeah, crazy, confluence of timing for us, especially because the Prison Music Project and this album, Long Time Gone, has been 10 years in the making. So crazy that it was finally ready to be born into this particular moment. But apropos, as you say, I feel blessed to be in the flow of what's happening with this work. It started 10 years ago. My friend Zoe, bookbinder, was going into New Folsom Prison out in California, doing, performances, starting with one performance. Thought they were going to go in there for an afternoon, have a very fascinating experience, and go on with their life, but Zoe, when they went into prison, was deeply affected by what they saw, the people they met, continued to go into New Folsom for about 5 years. And, performances quickly turn into workshops and just dialoguing, because people in prison so often are really starved for all things human, to be able to communicate themselves and tell their own stories and have, some affirmation of their humanity and their experiences and all of the sides of themselves other than criminal or perpetrator that exist. So Zoe found themselves collaborating with incarcerated men that she met there at New Folsom, and over a few years sort of built up this pile of songs, raps, poems, that were collaboratively created by Zoe and the incarcerated people who attended her workshops. So she came to me with this pile of songs and said, "Ani, I want to make this into a record, and you're the guy, I just know it." And I listened to the material and it was just incredible. And so we embarked on another 5-year process of like roping in a bunch of singers, players, producers, most of whom worked for free, as Zoe and I did. We made a record. We made a record with the only intention being really just to show the outside world, the greater world, who may not have any loved ones in prison, who may not have a direct connection with the justice system, with, whose lives have not been directly affected, that, the 2 million people that are in prison in the United States are people. And just really that's sort of at the core of it, is to just reach, the greater mind and heart of America and say, wow, there's this thing that's happening that is easy to not be aware of. Again, if it doesn't directly affect your family and friends, but it's a human rights crisis. And we just want to show that there are many people living in prison who have a lot to offer this world and whose lives matter as well.
And the songs are so good, every mm-hmm. single time. I mean, that's the thing that jumps out, because when you hear what the project is, I will admit my first thought was, oh, we have some amateur songwriters here and what's this going to be? And that's just not the case. Like, everything here is really good. There's a quote that's on the press sheet, the one sheet that says, "They are not bad people, they are hurt people." And I thought that was really important too, because as you're saying, what we know about the prison system, especially when we don't have anyone inside, is usually biased in some way, even if it's unintentional. And I'll use another line that I read from that press release that says, the prison system's been in place to entrench poverty and perpetuate racial inequality. And that's the big deal there, because there, as we hear now, there are so many people that are in the prison system for things that you shouldn't be in prison for. And you know, before you got into this, you've been an activist all of your career. Did you know much? Was this a big subject that you were, that you had dove into before?
Yeah, it's kind of been a part of my journey from the beginning. When I was very young, I discerned, like, you know, sort of teenager, early 20s, I realized that I am against the death penalty. You know, it occurred to me that killing, even by even state sanctioned killing, you know, I'm a pacifist. I don't think war is the answer. I don't think capital punishment is the answer. I think murder, you know, comes in many forms. And that, you know, the state, you know, an execution, basically what I learned, you know, as I started to get to know people who do anti-death penalty work and such, you know, that the state killing somebody is not the end of a cycle of violence. You know, it's the continuation of it. And an execution reverberates out its trauma through families, through communities, just like any killing, you know. So that was my entry point, was being anti-death penalty, getting involved with people who work to end the death penalty in America. And, you know, in those early days, I think I accepted the idea that, for instance, life without parole is a humane alternative to capital punishment, you know, and things like that, you know, that you are told, that may make sense on the surface. The more I stayed involved with people who do justice work, people who do defense work, I learned that life without parole, as it's doled out just wantonly in this country, can amount to the longest, slowest death sentence, the most painful death sentence a person can receive. And then, you know, the more that you stay involved with criminal justice, the more that you become very, it becomes very clear that justice is not blind, you know, that justice sees color, sees race very vividly, that justice sees class very vividly, et cetera, et cetera. It has all the social ills that the greater society has, you know, so it is not handed out evenly. It is not, you know, some people's, you know, basically, I think we all, it would be hard to deny that if you're poor and you are Black and you kill one person, you make your life may be considered worthless and thrown away forever. And if you are rich and you are white, you can maybe devastate thousands and kill thousands with your actions, with your lack of care and love and understanding of your connection to other people. And you may be greatly rewarded for that, not, you know, not punished at all. So we see these great inequities in our society. They play out in our criminal justice system. We see a human rights crisis of mass incarceration and all of these sort of systematic abuses that start with the cop on the beat and end up with the electric chair. So, you know, that's sort of in the background of this prison music project, is through telling these very immediate stories of these very real people, to also speak to the broader circumstance, you know, of mass incarceration, of a justice system that is badly in need of reckoning.
You've even got one artist a part of this. Forgive me, I'm blanking on his last name, but Spooner, right?
And he's Spoon Jackson.
Yeah, Spoon's been, and he's been in the system for decades, and for as I read, for so much time beyond his early years, he's been basically a speaker and a peace activist, yet is still, I mean, that's got to be, that story is, it can't be just, you know, one unique thing. That it's probably something that happens over and over, like, when is enough enough?
Right.
You're releasing this at a time when, what, the first two federal executions in forever have once again happened. I mean, you talk about, you know, the cop on the beat leads to the electric chair, or if you're George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, the cop on the beat leads to instant death. I know this isn't lost on you all, and you're basically painting it out already, but releasing this now, was that part of the conversation? I mean, did you realize as it was coming out that this was going to be lined up in such a way? And what have those conversations been like? I mean, does the album speak to anything that you didn't expect it to?
You know, it was the timing of the release had nothing to do with, you know, the events in society around it. It was 10 years leading up to, it was going to come out this June and we were going to go on tour and play these songs in real time for people and talk to people about the project. It's a not-for-profit record and the proceeds go to the Southern Center for Human Rights. So all of this was planned as a live in-person tour release, you know, your typical pre-pandemic release. So then the way it all timed out was just extraordinary. I mean, I think it you know, just this civil uprising against racial injustice, against the criminal injustice system. So it just makes me feel reassured, you know, that it, you know, this kind of, I think when serendipity happens in your life, it means you're in the flow, you know, that you are moving with how and with what you're meant to move with, and that, you know, the universe is conspiring, you know. So it just felt not surprising that this was, you know, after 10 years of work, that this was the stage that we, you know, rolled this project out onto.
And as a lifelong activist, I don't know, it must be nice to see the citizen journalism bit take off here, because with cell phones, with live streaming, I mean, when you put the power in the people's hands, I feel like I'm probably quoting something you've said in the past just naturally here. I mean, but the balance starts to find itself. I mean, that's, again, I'm asking as the lifelong activist, you know, what's it been like to see this movement transpire in the way it has?
Oh, I mean, just thrilling. Just hearing the words white supremacy come off the TV, come out of people's mouths everywhere in mainstream culture. It's radical, radical stuff. I mean, in that it's not radical stuff. It's basic truth,
right,
that has existed as long as our country has existed. What is radical is to hear the words spoken beyond, you know, our lefty, you know, whatever the, you know, the stereotype of the, you know, radical communist, you know, however we are pigeonholed as lefty extremists, who are really just for many generations trying to, you know, stave the damage of things like white supremacy, trying to speak to the reality, trying to address and evolve this country to be what it purports to be. So I find it really thrilling, you know, to hear white supremacy as a part of the dominant discourse, as a part of our lexicon now. And I think, because I know that unless you can speak the words, you first have to say the words, you know, to address the concepts and therefore to evolve them, to really become accountable. So just the hearing of those words beyond the radical left is really very hopeful, you know, and I really do also hope that if we can start unpacking white supremacy and really addressing it, we are walking ourselves back to being able to say patriarchy, you know, on the TV and talking about it every day as though it's the fundamental power imbalance that is affecting everything and from which we can simply not arrive at world peace, you know? So I feel like we're beginning to walk ourselves back as a society through, you know, a lot of the delusions and into the reality that can help us really start to move forward.
Right. And especially, as we look towards November, not to push aside the album right here, but I, again, with the timing, a lot of this speaks towards where we're going. I say that specifically in that the Democratic candidate, Joe Biden, has promised that there would be a woman vice presidential candidate with him, and has even alluded to several times that he would consciously be a one-term president. So to me, that's meant we're voting on her. That's who we're voting on this time around.
I'm thrilled at the idea that, you know, we may have our first female vice president, of course. And I am thrilled with the idea that Biden is approaching this new challenge with humility. Mm-hmm. And I do think that he would do very well to understand that this evolution is of a generation that is not his, and that he should do a lot of listening and a lot of deferring. And that feels like it's becoming the vibe of his campaign. And I really, because he was sort of last on my list of the Democratic field in terms of who I was excited about. But I do feel he's a basically good person who basically, his basic motivation is to be a public servant. And so I do hope he understands and approaches, yeah, with that sort of humility and deference to a new generation that is ready, very ready to change the game. And that he will be the facilitator of that, you know. But so I'm just gonna, you know, I mean, I guess I shy away from, focusing on individuals and personalities in politics in favor of, you know, broader concepts and, you know, such as voting. Like, I think right now, what is epically important is to channel the righteous rage of the streets into the voting booths, you know, because we have nonviolent revolution at our fingertips, you know. It's called voter participation, you know, and I think if we all show up and we vote them out, all these people that we know to be extremely destructive to our liberty, our freedom, and our very democracy, we can be the change that we seek. You know, I think it starts with voting. So what I mostly like to talk about, you know, in terms of voting is that, it, I guess, you know, in recent years, is to caution against the cult of personality. Mm-hmm. Or even this sort of recurring messaging that you hear about making your voice heard, as though voting is a form of self-expression. Because I think it's very frustrating and disappointing as a form of self-expression. I think that there are much more fabulous ways to express yourself that are available to us Americans. You know, you can go on YouTube and, you know, dance naked for the world, right now. So why would voting hold any sort of weight in that delicious need of people and experience to show themselves and who they are and their vision of the world? You know, you can write a song, you can do so many, you can dye your hair pink, or you can do so many fun things to express yourself and show the world yourself and put yourself out there. I think when it comes to voting, it would be expedient for us to talk about it in terms of a moment where we put ourselves and this hyper-individualism and self-expression that anchors our American culture, when we put it down. And this is the moment when we recognize that we are a part of something bigger and that we have to serve it. You know, democracy is not a spectator sport. And even if you don't get your ideal candidate who represents and embodies you and all that you want, I think that showing up as a service to the collective even if it's not satisfying, even especially when it's not satisfying and thrilling. That is when you're really doing your job as a citizen. Even if you only get the lesser of two evils, the lesser of two evils for somebody living very close to the line is life and death. Mm. You know, so you do it not for yourself and for your self-expression, but for all of us together.
You always say it perfectly sentiment there. And you know, I'll point out, you know, it lines up. When we started this series, it was the Democratic primary day here in Kentucky when we started this live series on Consequence of Sound. And the debate, of course, that's going to continue to be the debate, I assume, for the next couple months is mail-in voting. We had the highest voting amounts that we've ever had in our history for this kind of race, which just goes to show. And I want to tie that back around and close out here again with this Prison Music Project and the album Long Time Gone, because I think the only thing we hadn't talked about here is part of the conversation is making sure these people that have been behind bars for whatever reason can vote. It seems like this is it feels like it has more momentum than ever right now. But I mean, this is one of those things that could easily be a game changer for so many states, you know, giving these people that voice again. Do you have a feeling if this is going to be something that is in place for this or the next election?
I have a feeling of great hope. You know, certainly this pandemic has given extra weight and urgency to concepts like mass incarceration. I mean, they're not concepts, it's a reality. You know, this, I'll just say it, fascist insurgency in our nation has given extra urgency to issues like formerly incarcerated or felons being given the right to vote and participate in their democracy when they're released. You know, we have to be real about the fact that we've had a society that has locked up people willy-nilly. Many, many, many people, many nonviolent criminals, we make felons out of the guy next door every day in America, especially if they have dark skin or if they have very little money. So I think, again, it comes back to that same idea that just because you've been in prison doesn't mean that you are not smart, that you are not good, that your vote doesn't matter, or that you shouldn't have a right after you have done your time, at least, and paid your dues to be seen in your full humanity and participate in society fully. So yeah, there's a lot of people amplifying, you know, these crusades for justice. I do see movement. I see more receptivity than ever before to these concepts, again, that have been around for a long time. People have been fighting on these fronts for a long time. So I think that there's a lot of receptivity and the time is now to make these changes.
Absolutely. And beyond all that, it was just, it's been a racist law the entire time. If they wanted to suppress the black vote, then they put the black people in the jails. And then, yes, it is time to change that. And I'm
black
so happy.
And white. It is black and white. You're so right.
Yeah. I'm always so thrilled to catch up with you. What you do is important work, and I thank you for that. I know we all thank you for that. And again, everyone watching, listening, please check out the Prison Music Project, this album, Long Time Gone. Again, Ani DeFranco, Zoe Bookbinder. Am I saying her name right?
That's right, yeah.
And putting the art out of so many voices that aren't being heard right now into songs that are just amazing. They're amazing songs. They really are.
Cool, Kyle. Thanks. Yeah. It's a lot of people beyond me and Zoe that made this record what it is. And I'll just tell you, now Zoe and I and some of the other writers who are still incarcerated are going to collaborate on a stage play.
Oh, cool.
Using some of the material, building more musical material and telling the story of one of our collective and their experience with restorative justice. It's a powerful, powerful story. So that'll be the next evolution of the Prison Music Project.
Yeah, and that's a term that everyone should look up, restorative justice, as well as the BREATHE Act. I know we didn't get to talk about that as well, but that's definitely something everybody needs to check out as well. Ani, thank you so much for joining me on here today.
Thank you.
My thanks. Again, the Prison Music Project, the album is called Long Time Gone. Now, Ani and I have caught up plenty of times over the past few years, so I'm going to include those three interviews here as well. And this first one goes back to 2018, when we were talking about the 20th anniversary of her 1998 LP, Little Plastic Castles, the album's lyrical response to her popularity at the time, as well as producing for Dan Byrne and appearing on King of the Hill. We also touch on the 25th anniversary of Puddle Dive, and the news at that point of her autobiography. Part two of Kyle Meredith with Ani DeFranco.
Hey, Kyle, it's Ani.
How are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Let's go back down that lane into the time machine, back to the big old year of 1998. I was just looking at, you know, what your life looked like on paper, at least, around that time. And it sort of looked insane, honestly. Like, the amount that you were doing.
That's how I remember it. Yeah, it was kind of the apex for me of 1998, of notoriety, fame, people at the shows, scale of the tours, you know, all over the world, lots of glamour in my face, you know, that was the height of it, for sure. The record that we're talking about, Little Plastic Castle, seemed to be one that more people checked in with before or since.
Right. Well, that's what, you know, to talk about a record like this, you sort of have to talk about, you know, a bit of what led up to it, too, because, you know, you're the studio record that preceded this one, it had put you in a larger spotlight. And obviously the live album that came out in 97, you know, that is now what I read, Rolling Stone calls it one of the essential releases of the 90s. Like, it was such a big deal. Was Little Plastic Castles sort of a reaction to the success that was going on? Because lyrically, that's sort of how it sounds still.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you can hear the craziness of my life coming through the songs. In fact, so yesterday when I knew I was going to talk to you, I was like, oh, what is that record? I don't remember that record. So just for you, Kyle, I went to try to go listen to it. I was like, how am I going to remember anything? Listen to it. Go listen to it. I listened to some of it as much as, you know, my emotional state could handle, just to put me back in that place. And I noticed exactly what you're saying, a lot of reactions to this sort of fame and, you know, that sort of position of celebrity, and a lot of critical, you know, assessment and judgment by, you know, the big greater world. And yeah, there's a lot of, yeah, just living in a glass house, little plastic castle, you know, I'm in a fishbowl.
Right.
I'm literally in a fishbowl on the cover. So, yep, that's what my life was feeling like. And in fact, now that I'm remembering back, Little Plastic Castle was the record that in which I decided to stop reading press about me.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, I realized, you know, when that record came out, and it's a bunch of songs that are reacting to the reactions to the reactions to the reactions to me, I thought, well, this is an inward spiral. I just have to get out of it. And when that record came out, I deliberately did not read the critical assessment of it, and I've sort of never gone back to, you know, taking all of that in, because it's just too overwhelming.
Well, that's interesting then, because that's exactly what the reviews of this record were about. It was the reaction to the reaction to the reaction to the reaction, because what a lot of them, it seemed like so many of them, and I apologize, I don't have the complete lyric in front of me, but it had to do with you changing the shade of your lipstick was not, you know, suddenly a voice for all of womankind. You know, it wasn't like this movement every time that a magazine took a picture of you in a different, you know, style or whatever. And that's what they centered it on. So, yeah, it was just this circle and circle.
Yeah, I was really struck at the time. And in retrospect, I still am, that when you get to that level of notoriety, like I was in 1998, people, and I don't know, maybe I'm unique, but the press sort of suddenly they assume, because I'm famous now, that everything I do is for the public. Everything is for them. Yeah, that this lipstick is my statement about something, about an image that I'm projecting for them. You know, and I don't know if I'm just a simple person, simple-minded, but I was still just living for me. That lipstick was because, I don't know, my friend said, hey, check this out, or... I really wasn't doing anything for image, or, you know, all of that was kind of not in my mind. I'm a little more random about that and focused on my immediate, my near and dear and my friends and my life in front of me. And then the sort of the public reaction to all that and all of this meaning that was foisted upon every little detail of me all of a sudden seemed kind of artificial.
Right. Like, I can tell you, you know, growing up in rural Kentucky, that this is the album that was really my introduction to you. So it took a little while to get to me down here. Mm-hmm. And I can remember I was in high school and one of my best friends was sitting behind me and she said, you got to hear this. And she puts the headphones over my ears and it was the song Fuel. Me not knowing any of the background of what we're talking about now, of course, there was no context of that. So it spoke to me in present day of everything else that was happening, you know, and I think that's probably what you're going to hope for. I mean, for songs for this specific to still find a way to relate, you know, to a 16-year-old guy in the middle of Kentucky, that's no small feat.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. And yeah, it's funny, when I was listening back to some of the stuff yesterday, that record, another one of my memories of that album and that moment was that a lot of the audience that was familiar with me all along, you know, the sort of the core audience of, you know, feminists that had gathered around my work from the first album, that was the moment where they all said, sell out. You're a sellout now. You've gone commercial. And suddenly Little Plastic Castle was too commercial for them, or it was a sign of that I was done. I was doomed to some, you know, rock star superfluousness. And I was listening to it yesterday going, wow, this is, yeah, you know, this is me selling out. It's still pretty individual and quirky and specific to me, you know, listening back.
Well, you know, sound-wise, and I can bring that up with sort of that in mind, because this was, please welcome the brass. You know, here's the brass section. And you hear a song like Deep Dish, which is basically a dance number. And that, you know, what I took from that, you know, so when they hear that, they heard Sellout. What I took from that is, you know, under all this pressure, it sounds like you still found a way to have fun.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I had a big band, which means I was not touring alone anymore. You know, my early years were spent very solitary life, you know, traveling folk singer on her own a lot of the time, or just with my drummer friend Andy. You know, so, but at this point, my audience has grown, the venues have grown. I had enough resources to hire a crew to help me out with sound, and then I've got a band around me now. So I've got friends. I'm traveling around the world with friends, and we're having a lot of fun listening to music, experiencing the world together. So yeah, there was a lot of joy, even though there was a lot of sort of pressure and definitely downsides to that kind of celebrity.
Do you remember writing that song specifically, the Deep Dish?
Deep Dish? I kind of do. I can picture the bar in Chicago where it's sort of where the seed of the song came from. You know, I went out to hear some blues, you know, at a Chicago, you know, electric blues. And, first we literally had deep dish pizza. And then we went out to a blues bar and danced. And I was hanging out with my band and Dan Byrne, a folk singer at large. Don't know if you know his work, but it was just not a deep meaning song, you know, but just a reflection of a good time.
Well, Dan Byrne, you know, I'll talk about some of the other things that was sort of happening that year, because again, what a whirlwind of a period. You produced a Dan Byrne record that year, as I read.
Yeah. Oh, was it that same year? Yeah. We were hanging out a lot, and he asked me, you know, bless him, to produce his record that he had was writing at the time. And I, you know, I hope I did him justice. You know, in retrospect, I think, why, you know, I mean, I was, you know, I don't come from recording and producing and mixing, but for some reason my personality was like, oh, I can do this. I don't need anybody, you know. And that's one thing to have that ethic with your own music, but then to step into the producing and mixing chair for somebody else that early on, you know, I mean, I hope I did dance. Tunes Justice on that 50 Eggs record. He's such a great songwriter and performer. And
you were also on King of the Hill in
98. Yeah.
What was it you were?
Was the beginning and the end of my voiceover work, however.
I do remember that. I remember the episode. I remember seeing it, but for the life of me, I can't remember what your character was at the moment.
I think it was basically supposed to be me. It was a guitar teacher for what it was, the guitar, you know, the young punky chick guitar teacher for the kid. Yeah.
That's a nice classic episode. I'll also say, somehow in all of this, you got married that year too. And that's maybe the part of this that sounds the most incredible, that, you know, in all of this, you went, and we're going to do this. Like, did that play against or with everything else that you were doing? Did that sort of also seem part of the whirlwind?
Yeah, I mean, the fellow that I married had been touring with me for years. He was the first, when I sort of got enough resources, to hire, you know, a sound guy. That was what I desperately needed in life. You know, all those early years working with the house sound guy every night, it was a struggle, boy. They did not appreciate my ideas about the acoustic guitar. Everywhere I went, I made people angry, telling them I want all the high end to go away and I want the low end to feel like a Mack truck, you know, and it's a little chick with an acoustic guitar, and they just all folded their arms and shook their heads at me like, no. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was hard trying to interface every day with a resistant fella behind the soundboard. So finally I was like, oh, I can get my own sound guy. And I hired Goat, and Goat started touring with me and Andy, my drummer, and we fell in love. And it was, you know, an unfortunate thing in that he had a partner, I kind of had a partner, you know, so it was a lot of drama, you know, that manifested into records like Dilate, you know. And then when we finally came through it and, you know, extricated ourselves from our relationships and got together, it was such a relief. As anybody who's been in this experience knows, it was just instant. Let's get married.
Yeah.
We did it. We came through the fire. Let's get married. And yeah, we did that too, right in that swirl.
Yeah. I've sort of lived a similar situation in that, so I do understand completely. Mm. Minus the sound man and guitar and all that part of it. But yeah, the broad strokes.
Yeah.
So after all was said and done, Glass House ends up being Grammy nominated. I think this was your second time getting Grammy nominated at that point. So I don't know. I don't know how much, you know, weight you give that, but it, you know, it would seem like there is at least some, like with all the criticism that may or may not be happening at the time, that there is at least some reassurance there that, you know, you're doing good things. You're doing great things. Does it come off like that?
Yeah, I mean, well, I can't really remember what it felt like at the time. You know, probably pretty surprising. Looking back, it seems even more surprising to me. I mean, not to flag the Grammy thing, but, you know, we all sort of know that that's an industry game, you know, the Grammys. And the people who vote for the Grammy winners are label people, you know. So obviously the big labels with the big artists that have 1,000 in-house people to vote, it's sort of the top of the pops rules the Grammys. And for me to come totally from the outside with none of this, I don't know, to even be nominated in the sort of in the industry world when I'm not really in it, you know, was kind of a coup. And so that was, it was definitely very affirming, you know, to be sort of recognized in that, in pop culture, even though I was kind of an outsider coming in.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know who the heck nominated me. You know, I must have been making a bit of noise out there. So.
Yeah. And rightfully so, I will say. I want to bring up a couple of lyrics from actually a previous record, Puddle Dive, which came out in 93 on its 25th anniversary. But I was listening to that one, too, and I heard Egos Like Hairdos, and it has the line, the press will fatten you up and then dig in. And I thought, how prophetic was that, that you hadn't yet exactly lived through that, you know, and yet you already had your sights on it.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, songwriting for me has always been kind of prophetic. Like, I write things, I don't know, they just come from my little spleen, and I write them, and then sometimes I look at them, and I think, what does that even mean? I don't know. And then, you know, a year or two later, I go, oh, that's what that means. Yeah, that's, I'm living it now. It's interesting how that has happened. You know, to me, it just speaks to this kind of, you know, other plane that art exists on or comes from, you know, that is sort of deeper than our conscious mind. And to me, it just speaks to sort of this mysterious aspect of being conscious where you know much more than you're thinking. Stuff that you know subconsciously that is pretty deep and wide. And if you can access it, there's information there, you know, and art is a way of doing that. But yeah, I totally agree. It's like, how would I have known anything about that situation yet? Except you sort of do. You know what's coming. You know more than you know.
And certainly it lined up that way. And there's another one from that album that plays into more present day, Blood in the Boardroom. You said, I can make life, I can make breath. And I thought that came back around when Play God ended up being a song. It sort of found its seat again. And Play God ends up being one of my all favorite songs of yours of all time. So it's kind of...
Yeah, well, first of all, bless your heart for diving right back into Puddle Dive. And Blood in the Boardroom, that is not music for the faint of heart. You are an honorary feminist avenger, sir.
I'll take it.
But yeah, I mean, I guess, very early on, I had that kind of instinctual sense of, these sort of powerful men, you know, with power and money and position, you know, that's one kind of power. But I was trying to pit this feminine power of, you know, you can control a lot of stuff, including death, you know, in this culture, in this political landscape. But I can make life, you know, you know.
I mean, that's the most powerful of all powerful things, the creation of life. Mm. And you think that that my gender would have figured that out by now, but not so much. Not so much.
Well, we have to get back to it. We have to get back to it. We've told ourselves a lot of different stories in the meantime, but, you know, if you go back to, like, the first expressions of art, you know, the first human renderings and sculpture, you see this goddess, this fertile goddess figure, you know, with these big boobs and this big belly, you know, it's the symbol of creation, you know, it's like the miracle that we still speak of, the miracle of birth and creation. And that is the thing that we first expressed our reverence to, you know, humanity, you know, and since then it's gotten a little patriarchal, but, you know, we're all still here. Yeah, a little bit patriarchal, but it seems like, that the times are a changing right now.
Yeah, well, that certainly leads into the midterm elections are coming up, and I have to imagine that, you know, that's on your mind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm about to go back on tour and stomp around talking about voting, just trying to inspire people back into the voting booth. I'm so convinced that the voting booth is where we enact the revolution. Mm-hmm. It's as easy as that. It's so much easier than we think, you know. We're all sitting around pulling our hair out. What can I do? It's all so overwhelming. It's all gone so terribly wrong. You can show up on voting day and pull a few levers. It takes 10 minutes. I mean, you do have to get yourself registered and you do have to find a way to show up for 10 minutes on voting day. But that is all it takes. You know, if we all voted, all of us that could, boy, we'd have a beautiful new game.
I mean, it's been said many times that, you know, Republicans didn't put Trump in office and Democrats didn't put Trump in office and women or men didn't put Trump in office. It was the people who didn't vote who put Trump in office.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. I mean, we've had it's not accidental that we are in this situation. Certainly, you know, I'm a child of the, luckily I was born in 1970, so I had the 70s for formative years to feel this kind of America that is kind of gone now. But I and then the 80s, you know, boom, comes in Reagan, the me generation. It was the mind meld of just go shopping. You know, it was the generation where the cultural revolution was, you are consumers, not citizens. You are consumers, not citizens. You are, and it affected us. It affected young people. There was a real sort of lag of political activism. Of, you know, there was a kind of a break in a lot of the social movements, you know, and there was this, you know, the me generation was sold to us. And a lot of people bought in, so to speak. But I think we're finally waking up from that lie that actually happiness is not gotten through buying stuff. We need to find each other again.
I certainly hope so. I feel that wave as well. I want to see it crest now, you know? I want to see that wave finally break. I know, you know, Binary is barely a year old, I think, but, you know, I will ask, do you know what your next move is at this point?
Well, I spent the last year and a half writing a book. I don't know if I mentioned that when I was with you, but it's done. I wrote it. I wrote a book, past tense. And I'm just waiting for it to get pushed into a little book form, and it's going to come out in the spring. So, yeah, that's my new trick.
That's your new trick. Wow.
You know,
this is the life story?
Complete sentences. Yeah, memoir. Memoir with a lot of pontification, you know me. A lot of just what is in my mind, you know, and what I can remember. So, yeah, it's sort of a lot of going back to the, you know, the era of Little Plastic Castle and the whole ride of the 90s, you know, from my seat on the roller coaster, you know.
You've got a hell of a story. I can't wait to read it and take that trip with you then.
Yeah, that'll be a new trip for me, you know, going to bookstores.
Right.
And, I don't know what happens when you release a book, but it'll be a new game.
Well, I can't wait to see that happen and to experience that as well with you. Ani, thanks so much, as always, for doing this. You know, I'm always such a big fan, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, Kyle, nice to talk to you always. Thanks so much to you.
All right, Ani, we'll see you around.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
All right, cool. Bye.
A 2018 interview now. We'll go back 1 year further than that, 2017. This finds us talking about her record Binary that had just come out, writing about motherhood, going inward, her personal life. She had rekindled the fire that made her an activism force to be reckoned with for the past, you know, several decades. We got into reproductive freedom, criminal justice, all set to the rhythms and sounds that echoed her New Orleans surroundings. Part 3 of Ani DeFranco.
Hey, Kyle, it's Ani calling.
How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm well. I'm Binary, yay. What a great record.
Yay. Oh, cool. Binary, yay.
Yeah. That's a way
that's
to say.
My favorite review.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's, you can put that on your press sheet right there. Binary, yay, Kyle Meredith. Is this, I don't know if you keep count. Is this album 19 or 20? Because I've seen it both ways. And one seems like a big milestone.
No. Oh, really? Because somebody said 21 to me the other day.
See?
So obviously counting is not for the artistic,
none
creative.
Of us.
Exactly. I don't know. I'm going to go with 20. I like the round number vibe.
All right. And we can keep saying 20 until it's not, if we need to.
Until it's true, because it's the age of say it and it is true.
Right. I guess the way to start then is kind of looking back at that last album, because it almost seemed like you were afforded, I don't know, a quick breather with the last record as far as tackling things. And there were some things on there, but the bigger picture stuff. And maybe now it was time to get back, I don't know, on the warpath. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the album before this one came, you know, over the span of a baby coming into the world and been having an infant in my life. So that's just naturally an inward looking time. You know, you're just grappling with, you know, wiping butts and nursing and all of that stuff. And then you come back out into the world, you know, the ebb and flow of life.
Right. And there's so many targets for subject matter at this point. I mean, do you let them
really?
Come to you, or do you go hunting and start chiseling? Like, How do you,
I mean, I guess I'm, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm blessed with like an overactive
spleen. I don't know if left is the word. But I'll tell you, every Eastern medicine, you know, healer person that I've ever seen, you know, like Chinese doctor, the first thing you do is stick out your tongue. And the second thing that happens is they say, oh, you don't sleep. You worry. Your spleen. Boo, pow. I'm like, yep, that's me. So, you know, things just affect me. And many of them are, you know, outside of my personal sphere. I've never really been able to draw clear lines, you know, between my personal life and the life of my society. It seems like I'm always perilously in step, you know, right up to and including this recent, you know, implosion. Everything is upside down. Nobody knows what happens next. And the time is now to talk, to address, to act.
Yeah, it's still, I know a lot of these songs were, you know, they were written before the election, which seems to be the case with a lot of artists. So, mm-hmm. I mean, at that point, it's not like the conversations weren't already there. They just hadn't become mm-hmm. as heightened as they are now once the record is out. I mean, isn't it one of those things where you're writing these songs, the election hasn't happened, so you're pulling off campaign rhetoric and just the issues of the day, which there were more than enough. You know, mm-hmm. things to tackle, but suddenly it all does happen, and this album, unfortunately, has to make even more sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, a song like Play God, you know, like you say, these issues are always happening, you know, like reproductive freedom for women. Hello? Mm-hmm. Today? Mm-hmm. How about tomorrow? How about, you know? So I write this kind of anthemic song about reproductive freedom as a civil right, which is how I see it. And I think I'm under the impression that this song will be coming out in the first year of, you know, our first female president, you know, our first female in the Oval Office. And I'm thinking, all right, now is the time we're going to write this amendment to the Constitution. We're going to, you know, I've actually been calling a bunch of my genius feminist lawyer friends, and we're trying to get a coalition together to start forming the language, and let's try to articulate this vision of what we mean when we say reproductive freedom is a civil right. And let's write this amendment, and let's talk about it. Maybe somebody in the Oval Office who can talk about it in the first person is all the momentum we're going to need. And then lo and behold, actually, like you say, maybe all of this work needs to be done even more now, of course, because it's a crisis situation.
You just never get the chance. You know, I say that last album was a chance to breathe, but you just never really get the chance to breathe.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, in this world, right, you have to take your chance to breathe and hope that when you're done breathing, the world you love still exists.
Right. And I don't know, like the way you talk about this, is it really leads into that next thought I had, because it's one thing to talk about the big issues, but when you're a songwriter, you also want to make it personal to the listener and to you, I guess, to make it effective. And that's what I go after, you know, mm-hmm. reproductive rights, you know, it's the topic we're on. But even for the other things, like to grab those issues that are personal to you and not just the big thoughts. How mm-hmm. important is that for you as a songwriter?
Well, I think it's super important, yeah, for art to connect, that it be coming from someplace very deep. You know, which is to say, and I think it's in that super deep place that you connect with the universe outside yourself, that you tap into, you know, the one love, the one consciousness that there is. So, yeah, like, it's funny, I get described or introduced. I was just in New York doing a lot of stuff and somebody introduced me on stage again the other night, and they talk about, you know, often it's the way people describe my politics and my work and my art. They notice the feminism. They notice the queer politics. That always gets brought up. Entrepreneur is a word that haunts me and follows me around. I still don't get that one. And oftentimes it comes before activist in the list of what I am, which just makes me crazy. But nobody ever says criminal justice, which has been such a huge, I mean, it's factored into my songs. It's factored into my activist life hugely. But because it doesn't fit that kind of stereotype of me, it gets, mm-hmm. it goes unnoticed. But yeah, criminal justice is something that I've been made aware of very early on because my manager was a criminal defense lawyer before he was my manager, and all of his friends and all of the community of the anti-death penalty and prisoners' rights stuff. And on this new record, there's a song, Terrifying Sight, which is very much about that, about the criminal injustice system in our country and mass incarceration. And it's also very personal because, well, I have a friend now who was given a life in, you know, without parole sentence at the age of 19. I met him through this record that I've been working on for years called the Prison Music Project, which is going to come out later this year. And it's all songs written by dudes in prison, most of them lifers. Mm-hmm. And the one that I sang on the record is by this fella, Spoon Jackson. And he's become my pen pal, and we talk on the phone all the time. And he's been living in a cage for 39 years for a murder he committed when he was 19. But even guilty as he was of the crime, you know, he's a completely transformed human being. He has paid his debt to society many times over. He's a peaceful, very thoughtful, beautiful human being now with no recourse for mercy. It's just, and it, you know, like we're talking about, very personally, directly constricts my heart to have him as a friend and to just feel what it must be like to be him.
Right.
And living in a cage, and no one will recognize your humanity or your, you know, your need to be free now, after having, you know, evolved and really rehabilitated, which is supposedly the idea of prison.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, it's like you gotta care about things and take them into yourself and live them and feel them with people, and then you can write about them that way.
Yeah, I didn't know that part of the story, and you're right. I mean, as soon as you said that, that's exact same thing that I thought. It's like you put them in there, and everyone says to rehabilitate them, but they don't ever want to see them again.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And even the ones that aren't. Proven guilty or whatever. I mean, you know, we heard a few things about a few years ago. Was the Memphis Three? Was the Memphis Three or Memphis Five? Whatever it was. But you know, the kids who just, and they end up all getting out because of one of these compilations. You know, one of these compilations,
yeah, right?
Shed the light on it, and suddenly, you know, puts the conversation. I know there's so many people that don't get that opportunity, that don't get the spotlight to come their way. So.
I know. To think about it, yeah. One of the organizations I'm involved with is the Innocence Project, which has a New Orleans chapter down here where I live. And it's amazing how many innocent men are in prison, you know, or on death row, or, you know, get executed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an imperfect system, which is one of the major reasons why I think capital punishment is a crime and should be abolished, because, you know, our government literally executes innocent men just because people would rather have somebody go down for a crime,
right,
then, you know, admit that, no, we couldn't find the guy. So you just, you know, you find another guy. And it's very humbling. It's very humbling once you really start going into the world of prison and criminal justice. And boy, it makes me look in the mirror and go, don't you ever complain ever again.
Right. Well, I know you've been thanked many, many times for, you know, your activism and everything that goes along with that. But, you know, in moments like this, I'll thank you again for putting that spotlight on things like this. So,
yeah.
And I'll briefly switch gears here to also bring up the music, because the play on this record is outstanding. The musicianship.
Yeah, cool.
And I noticed that it feels like there is a bit, you know, your environment. New Orleans did make it onto this record. Especially when you drop a name like Neville into the guest list, like,
yeah,
how could it not?
Really.
Did you want it to? Did you want it to sound like a bit more New Orleans this time around?
You know, none of what I do these days is really calculated.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've grown beyond that. I just follow. I just, you know, there's somebody, the muse drops the breadcrumbs or something, and I just follow them. and I have no idea. I used to sort of come to an album with a plan or an idea, and after 20 records, or 19 or 21 or whatever, I realized, like, that's just silly, you know, because the process and the moment and the interactions overwhelm any kind of plan, as they should, you know, and they have a plan all of their own. So, yeah, I mean, I guess really just what happened is, you know, my drummer of these last bunch of years now is Terrence Higgins. He's born and bred in New Orleans, and, you know, it's in his DNA, you know, the sort of the rhythms of this place. They come out, you know, of him, you know, fully formed. And, yeah, and Ivan Neville is somebody that I've been playing more and more with the last few years. I think, you know, a bunch of years ago, I called him up to just, you know, overdub on some stuff I was working on. And it, you know, my jaw just drops every time he plays. I actually roped him into doing a little tour with me last year, and there's just some, he just brings the spirit every time. He's just such a startlingly deep musician. So, you know, yeah, this time out, I had him in at the bed track sessions. You know, I'm like, give me a 3-day window. I want to make a record with you, you know. So yeah. Ivan and Terrence are, you know, right there along with Todd Sickafoos as the sort of the beds of this record. So that's 2/3 New Orleans right there.
Mm-hmm. And it does. The guest list is fantastic, and it makes for a really, really good record. I'll go ahead and say again, yay binary. So it's...
yeah, cool. I'm pretty yay about it myself. I mean... Yeah. You can't go wrong. I mean, that's my oblique strategy worked for me, at least, you know, inviting all these killer musicians and elevated spirits into the party with me on this record. It's like, how could I not love it, too?
Right.
I've discovered the way to love my own record.
Have everybody else come on it.
Invite your friends. Right. Yeah.
I think that's a motto for life in general, so...
Yeah, amen.
Invite your friends. All right, Ani, it's so great to talk to you again. Well, hopefully we'll see you around these parts in Louisville eventually, but if not, have a great summer.
Oh, Kyle, thanks. So nice to talk to you, too.
All right, I'll see you. Take care.
All right.
Okay,
bye.
And now we'll round it up with a 2016 interview. This might have been the first time we've met. She called in to talk about her 2016 Vote Damn It tour and the politics that went along with it. So let's get into this one. Part 4 of Kyle Meredith with Ani DeFranco.
Hi, Kyle. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. We're excited to have you back in town.
Oh, cool. Excited to come back on the road.
Yeah.
See some of the great Southeast.
That's good. Well, we are excited to have you back up here in Louisville for the Vote Damn It. The Vote Damn It. There's a certain inflection
right.
You have to hit on that. The Vote Damn It.
Yeah, that's right. Get in the spirit. Yep. Yeah, I mean, I started doing Vote Damn It themed tours, I think in 2000, and then again in 2004, and just, you know, trying to get voter participation or help, you know, inspire a conversation about if we don't participate, then, you know, corruption and very undemocratic things ensue.
And it's more what you're talking about is more than just the presidential race, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that, of course, is as crucial as ever right now. We can't complain that we have two shades of gray to choose from, because we really do have a stark difference between our presidential candidates. But also, we have so many congressional races that are, you know, as important. And, you know, we've all seen, I think, in the Obama years, that even the most well-meaning president is sort of powerless if you have a Congress that's stacked with extremists and roadblockists, you know.
Right.
So in order for us to get anything done and move this country forward, I think we have to take all these races real seriously.
Yeah, I don't know if you've followed Kentucky politics at all, but we're having our own problem when, for the governor race, I think only 20% of folks showed up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and meanwhile, I think if we all just knuckled down and exercised our right to vote, you know, which was the brilliant thing about the first rounds of Vote Damn It tours that we did years ago, which we haven't got revamped, so I shouldn't even talk about it. But there was a great slideshow in between the sets that talked about voter history. And you look for a minute at how hard fought the right to vote was for so many people. And then the idea of squandering it becomes that much more ludicrous. You know, we're blessed to live in a democracy. And, you know, we should jump at the chance to empower ourselves and make our own choices and make the government really represent us. You know, I was looking up the Kentucky races, you know, in anticipation of talking to you, and I didn't really delve deeply into the candidates. But the first thing I noticed was in the Republican column how the funding of the campaigns was 5-6 times as much as in the Democratic categories, you know. So that right there is a red flag, you know. It just shows us how much we have to counteract with our own energy the power of money and business.
Yeah, it seems a lot of the time, you know, it comes down to apathy on a lot of people's parts, which, you know, for what you're doing out there seems the perfect sort of inspiration, because I would assume, like, you know, the crowd that you're talking to is probably on your side of the dial.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, maybe, you know, I wouldn't really call it preaching to the choir, because it's not that you're, because it seems like what you're trying to do is inspire those people to take those ideas,
exactly,
those like-minded ideas, and run with it.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. Inspire the choir to sing louder, to sing their own, you know, of themselves. I mean, I think that's really all I've been trying to say in all of these songs over the years, is just you have the power to become yourself. You know, you can not only make your own answers, you can make your own questions, you know, find your own questions, because often I feel like that's the problem with me and the world, my sort of feeling like a square peg in a round hole in this world is I think often we're asking the wrong questions. So the debates are, they never hit the mark, you know? Anyway, I digress. But yeah, I think just inspiring each other is what's so important. If you make yourself stronger, then people will come to you.
As a you know, as someone who sang a lot of protest songs over the years, we're all frustrated. But I would start to wonder, like, you know, you've kind of made this your job, and is it even more frustrating that here we are 25 years later, and you're still having to sing protest songs? You know, I was listening to "Take Down Your Flag" just the other day, and you know, I would that's a song that I hope you would never have to sing again. You know.
Yeah, I know. I've been revisiting a song from, 1999, I think, called To the Teeth, and playing it on stage. And it's basically a song about how far gone we seem to be with this culture of guns and this, again, strong business lobby that goes against an overwhelming opinion in among citizens that we should have more regulation. And it just, you know, I stand on stage every night and say, okay, I'm going to play a 16-year-old song, when the violence, the gun violence, seemed overwhelming then. And it's amazing how we acclimate and deny and excuse. It's, yeah, it does get kind of hard sometimes to keep trying to feel it all and you know, be present in it all.
Yeah, I would, you know, I don't think it's too personal here, but I know you have kids, and you know, as a protest singer, like, how do you talk to your kids about what, like, Orlando or any of these? Like, is there a conversation that you're having that you're putting out there for them?
I mean, my oldest is only 9, so, you know, she is not privy to the daily news. But we, you know, things have started to come up, you know, like I brought her to a protest and against, you know, police brutality in New Orleans. And And, you know, Mommy, what does hands up, don't shoot mean? Right. And, you know, what is this about? And it's started an ongoing conversation about racism. And having kids, you know, it makes it, puts it all right into the ludicrousy that it is, you know, right. Trying to explain something like racism to a child is like, you know, just it's the most ludicrous and sickening act as a parent.
I never thought of it. Like, I have a son, and he's the same age as your daughter, and I kind of go through, uh-huh. But I've never thought of it in that exact same way right there. Like, because it is, when you explain it, it's like, this is insane that this exists.
Yeah.
I'm having to say this.
Yeah. And then you're afraid that you're beginning the process that we were talking about, with guns, of acclimation to insanity, you know, accepting. I mean, that's one thing that I try to hold on to in my life and in my work is that initial outrage I felt as a young person about things like war. You know, I just seemed inexcusably insane. And, you know, I want to hold on to that feeling. I have a song somewhere along the way about, you know, I will maintain the truth I knew naturally as a child, you know, and you want that for your kids too. So it's hard to explain the actual world.
And now looking back on your last record with Allergic to Water, you know, you're as you talk about, you know, holding on, trying to regain these feelings and everything, but in a totally different sense, like you are in a different part of your life than you were then. Allergic to Water isn't, you know, the standard protest album. It's sort of a love album. It's got very sensual moments on it, even sexy moments on it. All, you know, all of this musically. You know, when you're Ani DiFranco and you're a protest singer, but it seems like you're in a period of your life where maybe you want to be something else.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just am something else, like you have noticed. You know, I had a baby, you know, that's 3 now, but over the course of making that record, I was pregnant, and then I had a newborn, and that's certainly a time when you go inward, you know, as a family, there's a lot of songs that come from inside that bubble, and over the years, you know, my life takes different shape like anybody's life. Sure. And sometimes I'm looking outward and I'm addressing my society, and sometimes I'm going inward. And it used to be, you know, that people would jump on me immediately for changing one degree left or right, you know, but I at least I hope that over as time goes on, that people, you know, understand for me as well as for themselves as we get older, you know, that things ebb and flow, that the things that you're paying attention to shift, and where you're putting your energy shifts, and that's as it should be, you know.
Right. Does it ever feel like, though, that maybe that you're dragging your history with you at times when you don't want to?
Oh, it does sometimes, you know, but it's pretty easy for me to come back to a place of gratitude, you know.
Yeah.
I look around and I think, wow, I have a cool job. It has its downsides. But if you ever hear me complaining, smack me.
Well, it has been just 2 years since Allergic to Water, but I think I read that your new album is sort of done?
Yeah, it's sort of done, exactly. Who knows, now that I'm on Kid Time, how long the last 5% takes, but I'm hoping to have it done in the fall and maybe out in the new year. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be out in this year, but that's looking a little squeezy. But yeah, it's there. The songs are there, and there's a lot of, I guess, whatever. It's my grab bag of big P politics. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that I have a strong desire to engage society about. Maybe, you know, now my kid is out of diapers, so I'm back in the ring.
What about the sounds? Because you're always kind of playing with sounds, which are catching your songwritings these days.
Well, this new record has a lot of great players on it. That's the really standout thing that's going to be happening here, is my band is so amazing these days with Todd and Terrence, who will be with me in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And then Ivan Neville plays on half the record, and Jenny Scheinman, this beautiful violinist, and others. I sort of made a few phone calls this time around and reached out to, I realized I have all these incredibly talented friends, you know, I should call them. And so there's a lot of little guest appearances on this new record too, which are pretty cool. Many spirits flying through.
Well, yeah. I can't wait for the new record. And more importantly, I'm so excited to see you this coming Monday here in Louisville. So
Arnie,
thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right.
All right, Kyle. Take care.
You too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
There you have it, 2016 interview with Ani. Again, seek out the Prison Music Project and the album Long Time Gone for what Ani's up to now. So a big thanks to Ani and a big thanks to you for checking out this episode. Before you get out of here, again, I hope you subscribe to this podcast so you can keep up with all of your favorite artists. Discover the new ones, know what's happening in the music world. Brand new interviews put out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can find us at all the major podcast hotspots like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you like to get your podcast from. After that, head to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. That's WFPK.org, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Consequence of Sound, they've got your music and film news. You can also find me on the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of them at Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith, and I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
I'm Lior Phillips, host of This Must Be The Gig. We're a weekly podcast that documents everything about the world of live music, speaking with choreographers, costume and set designers, the people who run beloved venues and festivals, and, of course, speaking with musicians about that one gig that changed their lives. Get your peek behind the curtain at consequenceofsound.net, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.